According to St. Thomas Aquinas, courage is an emotion before it's a virtue. It's something that arises in us naturally when we are faced by something we perceive as evil. This is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz, and you're listening to Wyoming Catholic College's weekly podcast, The After Dinner Scholar. At the Wyoming School of Catholic Thought, we discussed St. Thomas's understanding of the emotion or passion of courage with the help of Dr. Stanley Grove. Dr. Grove pointed out that the passions are buried deep down in Thomas's understanding of human nature. Through our rational nature, we take the world in with our intellects and reach out to the world with our wills. We sense the world through the animal aspect of our nature, that is, the part we share with other creatures who, while they are not in the image of God, also have bodies and live in the physical world. This includes our senses and our emotions or our passions. I asked Dr. Grove to concentrate his attention on how these passions, particularly the emotion of courage, allows us to interact with the world we live in. Dr. Grove, appetites and the responses to appetites separate plants from animals. So let me begin by asking what Thomas means by an appetite and how that's related to the passions or emotions.
St. Thomas follows Aristotle in his division of the living realm into three categories: plants, animals, and rational beings. That's us. Maybe I can back up and say that living things, for Aristotle and Aquinas, are things that have a unified functionality that transcends the activity of any of their parts. The parts, when functioning together as a whole, are doing more than they could do on their own. That's really the definition of living thing. So plants interact with their environment only through more or less direct contact. They're very passive in that sense. With the animal level of soul, or what is often called the sensitive soul, interaction with things at a distance becomes possible. So we have the five exterior senses. Sight is the most notable of those, but all of the senses, to some extent, can take in the other as other. For animals, that's always on a level of particularity. For rational beings, we engage with the other, things outside ourselves, on a universal level, in an immaterial way. That's what's proper to us as humans. As intellective beings, that's actually closest to what makes us in the image and likeness of God. At both the animal and rational levels, the soul can both take in, as it were, or apprehend things, and reach out to what is outside itself. And that's called the seeking or appetitive aspect of the soul. Now, insofar as we're animals, what we share with the lower animals is that we can take in things in a particular way through sensation, and we can reach out to things in a particular way, or maybe I should better say, we can act with respect to things outside ourselves in a particular way, and that's called emotion. As rational beings, we can take in again, and that's called intellectual knowing, or perhaps I should say, and we reach out to the other through rational volition or appetition, seeking, the seeking faculty, and that's called will. Now, all of this has to do with perfecting ourselves, becoming more perfect. It's part of the whole cosmic scheme of having come forth from God and returning to God. But as humans, we are animals also, so we don't lose our animal functions simply because we are rational and immaterial in our soul principle. Rather, we just have to elevate the animal functions.
Yeah, so the animal just functions out of its passions.
And, well,
we have a rational nature that controls that.
That's where I'm driving. I'm heading in that direction, exactly.
Let's look more directly at the passions or emotions.
To zero in here, the emotions, or what was called in the medieval scholastic tradition, the passions, two words for the same thing, are the soul's movements in response to an external object. That movement is ultimately directed towards our perfection, our self-perfection. We have to move towards an outside object that's good. Might be food, might be somebody we're falling in love with. We have to move with response to an outside object that's bad, a threat, a danger to be averted. We only grow, we only become ourselves, become more and more perfect in response to things outside ourselves. Clearly, we don't have within ourselves all of the resources necessary for becoming perfectly human. So it's all about interacting with what is outside ourselves. So, what are the emotions? Through sensation, through that animal level of knowing, we become aware of things outside ourselves that are either good or bad. And I don't mean morally good or bad. Yes, they could be morally good or bad, but prior to that, they're just good or bad with respect to our nature. So these objects, good or bad as the case may be, summon forth a response from us. These responses are called emotions because they are movements of the soul, movements with respect to an outside object, emotion. They were called passions in the earlier tradition, with all of the implication that that word has for us even today of passivity, of being passive, because it is only in response to something outside that the motion is set in motion. There are 11 emotions or passions in the scheme that St. Thomas presents us. Six of those are called concupiscible. And they are emotions defined with respect to an object that's good or bad, simply speaking. Three of them are defined with respect to a good object. Three of them are defined with respect to a bad object. The good object summons forth the emotions of love. Love would be the first inclination towards a good. It could be love for a wonderful human being. It could be love for a donut. It could be love for something which you perceive as good, but which is not actually good. Love for killing people. The emotions could be disordered, but considered in and of themselves, the object which defines the emotion, by which the emotion is characterized, is at least perceived as good. So love is the first of those. That's an inclination towards a perceived good. Desire is a distinct emotion which involves a more active impulse or dynamic toward that good. You could love something without necessarily desiring it at any given moment, right? You say, I love chocolate cake, but right now I'm full. I don't desire any. Mm-hmm. The third moment in that sequence of emotions ordered towards an outside good would be joy or delight, the possession of the good. So love, desire, joy. On the other hand, we have three emotions that are characterized with respect to an evil object, or at least an object perceived as evil. Hatred would be the foundational inclination toward I don't mean a movement towards evil, but I mean an emotion that's defined with respect to an evil. Right. Hatred would be the fundamental one. The emotion defined as having regard to some evil, something perceived as harmful. More dynamic, again, than mere hatred or dislike would be aversion. That's a moving away from the evil, just as desire is a moving toward the good. And then finally, sorrow or pain, that would be the emotion that arises or has arisen because the evil is unavoidable. You are in possession of it, or it is in possession of you. A stomach ache is an evil thing. That's, we might not necessarily use the word sorrow to describe it, but some suitably negative word denoting a thing that we perceive as not good for us, but we're stuck with it.
Yeah.
So those are the six simple emotions. There are five others called irascible, and they are defined, again, with respect to an object outside ourselves, but there's some complexity there. The object, whether it be good or evil, is apprehended or envisaged in connection with some other object that either stands between us and the primary object or stands beyond it. Hope and despair are two of these irascible emotions, and they're defined with respect to a good object. You hope to win the football game. Or you despair of what? Again, of winning the football game. So we might think that hope is a positive and good thing and despair is a negative and bad thing. Not necessarily. The moral dimension comes in later on. The emotion, purely and simply is defined with respect to an object that is good. However, there's an element of evil that has to be taken into account. The good that is only hoped for, not merely embraced or desired, but only hoped for, is a good that may not be attained because of some intervening evil. I hope to win the football game, but the other team is a lot better than we are, and they're bigger than we are. Similarly, despair, defined with respect to a good object, like winning the football game, is the emotion of giving up. You've allowed the intervening evil to overwhelm your hope of attaining the supervening good. Courage and fear are another pairing of these irascible emotions. They are defined with respect to an evil object, not a good object. Fear, pretty obviously, is an emotional state with response to an evil that is overwhelming us, or about to overwhelm us. We perceive it as likely to overwhelm us. What is courage? It's the emotion defined with respect to that same evil, but insofar as that evil may be overcome for the sake of a supervening good. So, courage is not an evil emotion because it's defined in terms of an evil object. Rather, it is defined as an emotion which faces an evil object for the sake of a supervening or transcending good. We are rational animals, and we share with the animals, certainly the higher animals, dogs for example, the emotions. Mm-hmm. They do have emotions. Yep. Courage. A dog which is defending its pups against a much bigger and scarier animal, maybe a bear that's attacking them, is giving evidence of courage. And we're not just naming it anthropomorphically, like, oh, it's kind of like us. Well, it is kind of like us because the animal has courage just as much as humans do. In the case of humans, it's a courage that has to be transformed by our intellectual nature, but you're probably going to go there in a minute. Huh?
Well, I was just going to say, why don't we go there? How do we transform this emotion of courage into a virtue?
Yes. When we were discussing this in the Wyoming School of Catholic Thought a couple of weeks ago, the point was made that courage, which we normally think of as a virtue, as a very human thing, firstly, it is an animal emotion. So, what is the virtue? The virtue is not found in the lower animals. Virtue is a moral quality found only in rational beings, which can regulate their animal behavior in accordance with what intellect perceives to be a higher good, an ultimate end. So, being courageous in a sort of spontaneous, emotive way is something that we're capable of, as well as dogs and moose and bears and so on. But to develop the habit of soul whereby you easily and readily incline to face a perceived evil for the sake of a transcending good, that's something that intellect must be involved in, right? It's only intellect that really apprehends the supervening good, or what I'm calling the transcending good, as a good worth facing an evil for. So we can, through intellectual or intentional repeated behaviors, condition ourselves, as it were, to be courageous in the right circumstances, to the right extent, with respect to the right ends. I mean, that's the humanizing of the emotion, the intellectualizing of what we share with the animals. So the virtue of courage becomes a habit whereby we easily and readily incline to behave courageously, as is most appropriate to our nature, which means as is most appropriate to attaining our ultimate end, which of course we apprehend intellectually.
St. Thomas, it seems to me, puts courage well within all of our reach. If courage is the human response to a threatening but conquerable evil, then we all have plenty of opportunities to feel courage and to develop that emotion into a virtue. And faith reminds us that we ought never give up that desire to conquer evil and hope for the good in our lives, in our families, in our church, in our nation, and in the world. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tomkiewicz.